refreshes and allow the folks who have just joined us. I understand the adjacent session was running out, and so there's some new folks that have joined us. And for those of you who have just come in and were not here for the earlier breakout session, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself, letting us know who you are and where you're from, that would be really helpful. We can start at this table and then, oh, pardon me, we can start right here.
I'm Kristen Porter, a freshman from Kappa.
I'm Chris Rector, I'm with Senator Angus King's office.
David Cousin, President of Maine Logs Association.
Paul Dane, Fishman, Screw's Head.
Hi, it's Kevin Harris. I'm from Maine Log Harris, the Marine Surveyor.
Gentlemen.
Oh, we're students from Searsport District High School.
We like students. Yeah. All right, terrific. So, just a very brief sort of context for folks who just joined us. We just spent about the last half an hour in small breakout groups discussing and exploring and digging into the issues and concerns that the fishing industry anticipates as wind energy development gets underway. So those may have to do with navigation or safety or liability or impacts to fish behavior, whatever it happens to be. So we spent some time digging into those. And now what we're going to do is reconvene as a small group, carry on those lively conversations, and this time be more solution focused, which is where my guess is many of you wanted to go in your earlier conversations and may have strayed to, which is fine. So again, we'll take the next 20 or 30 minutes. Each of your tables has a facilitator and a note taker, and we want to try to focus on specific suggestions that you may have that would help meet your needs as a fisherman, as wind energy is developed, and think about things that are fairly specific. Essentially, as Brian has noted, there's already a general or a generic list of best measurement practices or mitigation plans. What we're looking for is your ideas on specifics. So dig in. You've been given another handout at your table, and this one modeled similarly to the one you had in the first group, but this one again is focused on potential solutions for mitigation measures. Again, these are drawn from suggestions and conversations from meetings that we've held in the past, and we're inviting you to build upon that and to add detail where you can, even include new ideas. So with that, let's and when we finish from that, we will actually take a brief moment, and we will do what we hope is not the typical mind-numbing report out, but we'll do a quick report out from each of the tables of just some of the headlines and the highlights of the issues and suggestions for solution that came out. Not an index of them entirely. That will be in the meeting summary. So with that, let me invite you to resume your conversations, this time focusing on solutions.
Everybody's got one? Do we want to take some time to look through it, or do you want to just start with the first heading and just kind of brainstorm as we go through?
Which one?
I mean, we've obviously, communication. You see we've got it number one because it tends to be the big.
I would suggest a couple, as far as engagement goes, for a meeting like this, I would have, if asked, I would have said something like, take the Maine Lobstermen's Association newsletter, write a little article, and invite people to saying this is coming up next month or the month after, invite them. I'd suggest the commercial fisheries news as another one. Perhaps Down East Lobsterman's Association, things like that. Yeah, would have been a good approach to get more direct approach.
I think the point is that all of this is great, but it needs to happen at the local, at the very, very local level, working with the local lobster co-ops and the wharfs and each community. there are ways that you can get into them that you don't have to start at the Fisheries Council.
Okay, just remember, these, what we're trying to develop here is not necessarily for this meeting, but for what you would want the developer to do.
Right.
Okay.
So, go local.
But that's I think anything.
This is what we want to hear, is the specific ones to make. That you did exactly what you
suggested. Go local.
Maybe start local.
Yeah,
there's a confusion, and I mean, Maine is a confusing place. They're not, that's why VHF channel. There's hardly any fishermen, and really, there's quite a few of them that don't even monitor.
Well, just remember, these are
they're all going to be on different local channels, and it's a.
You guys did a great job on Facebook. Did you feel like that was effective?
Yeah, we feel that Facebook surprisingly gets a lot of attention in Washington County, and so that's a good way of getting. I mean, we've gone from an electronic mechanism like Facebook to actually going down to the breakwater and putting notices on people's trucks.
Yeah.
So that it's both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. And I think the other sort of best practice with a lot of this stuff too is piggybacking on meetings, like coming here to the forum or adding on to other. This whole idea of doing the education piece, where is that? Oh yeah, the public relations campaign to educate fishermen. I mean, it just hopefully understood you don't have a meeting just about that, but if you can add that onto other meetings, you'll get more people.
As far as the day-to-day communications, it'd be good for them to have a list of the various buying wars, like lobster buying wars, let's say, or Port Clyde dragons and things like that, which could be could be posted or something. In any event, like you were going to do construction, particularly.
That's why I was clear. So you focus at those locations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That group.
You could perhaps build up a list of locations.
Was there anything novel at the earlier ones that they came up with in terms of communications at Morehead City or something, answering the same or reviewing the same concept?
Well, it's been interesting. I mean, Facebook has actually come up. Yeah. Social media things have come up. Different. They have different art, different journal things that they have, but it's a struggle. I think everyone has to cope with because it's different. People, I don't really check that one. Or you check that one.
You can't. There's not one single.
Yeah, there is.
Just that I think I keep seeing statistics that the average commercial fisherman is over 50 and getting and up, and it's much less of the Facebook generation. Okay. That's why, mailing lists are always good. And I mean, I must have been on some mailing list to be notified by these folks here. But it was like 3 days ago.
Well, I think
very short term.
That's a good point. I think it's the spectrum. There's different avenues.
Right. Yeah.
Surprised how many are on place to another.
Social media just because they're in these remote locations.
Oh, yeah.
But, so there was
pick up on this way to
definitely develop a list of local.
There was a suggestion to go to, the health clinics and go, because going in Massachusetts, that was, that's where the fishermen are going.
The tackle shops and so on.
Absolutely. And because some people aren't. On social media, they're not using the VHF channel, but they're getting sick.
They are human beings. They do have these places.
But even for these meetings, there was a lot of contacting of heads of lobster associations or something like that. But they get so many emails that they may not know which ones to forward on. Sure they so it's. We can't always make the assumption that the head of a certain organization is going to forward an email.
What would really help, and maybe they've done it elsewhere, but. And that is a dedicated NGO that's there to be not a promoter of, simply a critical organization that says, show us what you have, not critical in that, all these stop the wind nuts, I'm saying, but the critical means let's get all the technical info out, let's examine it, just as, Maine People's Alliance does to a development project. This is good about it, this is good, but you need to do this. There'd be a one-stop shop for all the fishermen and other people to go to.
Well, they can't plan that.
Because right now it's, it's a, like you said, it's who do you ask? And, it's to get info. And if they knew there's one place to go, they could register their info. That'd be helpful is all I'm saying. But there just isn't such an organization.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's going to be the challenge for any proponent. No matter what stage you're in, where's the best way to start the process? And I think one of the big issues, big ideas, is a fishery liaison. And that right now is probably going to definitely be a BMP with the fishery liaison, a designated, that will be their duty to engage all the, you know, user groups.
I think the Island Institute's done a nice job for the most part.
Yeah, Ron, you like our emails?
Yeah, that's true. I know, but come on. I've never heard you ever say anything, you know, anything critical in the slightest about any of these projects. Maybe I haven't seen.
Well, we're not advocating for it either. I mean, we're sharing information is what we're trying to do.
Okay, okay.
I think it's a good model.
I mean there's nothing wrong with being an advocate, you know? Nothing wrong with advocacy, you know that.
When I sat down and said, what do I need to know before I go to this meeting?
Yeah.
What do I want to know ahead of time to get something out of it? I did call these guys.
We got the email. I have a question. How many has anyone at this table ever gone to the BOEM website and clicked on the state? And looked at the PowerPoints and all that?
Yeah, okay. I've been to all the BOEM meetings all up and down this coast for the last 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah, I know you go to I've seen you at the meetings and stuff. I just didn't know how actively that website is used. Did you find the information on there useful?
Yes and no. The yes part is that, you know, not only there, but you can go down to North Carolina or other states and see how the process is unrolling there. But I noticed it didn't seem like anything about the most recent event that was covered in it in Maine seemed to be from 6 months ago or more. Okay. I'm not sure if there's some update. I don't have.
It's a nice summary. Like it's sort of like here's what's happened to date in three paragraphs, which is really good if you're starting. But if people want more information, then it's like where do they go to? Have to dig on their own.
It might have been good to have links that said here's a link to the Deep Sea Winds project. Here's a link to the other project, Statoil's project here. These are the only two that are within the review process or planning, even if they're just planning. So access right to the actual projects in some way would be helpful.
Yep. I think sharing information that page even exists at meetings like this, because you do have to kind of navigate to it once you get to the BOEM site. You have to click 5 or 6 times to get there. But I think but if you let people know, go back, check this site periodically, that's where we're updating things. It's where you can find the latest, at least on the BOEM process.
And it was very good, though, to be able to go back to, like I said, other states and get the full, basically the publication you put out afterwards that detailed what everyone thought at these different places, so you see how issues.
There's one other thing I don't think we've touched on in this, when we talk about the differences between Maine and these other projects, is that Maine is coming sort of under the line of sight because it's 4 turbines. It's like this tiny little test thing, but and we don't know how to approach it as fishermen. Of course we'd let 3 or 4 turbines in to try this technology. We're not that greedy about this whole ocean, and we're not going to let 3 or 4 turbines in to try it. It's that what we don't know is how quickly those 3 or 4 turbines are going to turn into 100 square miles of the Gulf of Maine or something. And we're very paranoid that can happen very quickly after this first initial process gets done. So there's this unknown jump that's ahead of us between what this is being presented as and what we fear that it could be easily become.
It's like a lovely camel's nose.
It's never clarified what the connection might be or how much could be a reality.
There's some uncertainty. I mean, Statoil has been saying, we'll do these test ones here, full size. If it doesn't work out, so long, guys. We're going to tow them to shore and go somewhere else. And so until that point, I guess, you're basically in this cloud of uncertainty because they would like to get up to 80 of them out there. But at this point, they go, no, we're just looking at the 4 right now. Keep those blinders on, damn you.
It's a whole other process that they'd have to go through. There'd be a whole other lease. They'd have to lease a whole other area. So it really is premature right now to start thinking about, the large commercial scale project, at least for this particular one. I mean, part of the purpose of this meeting is maybe to think about ideas that you have.
I don't think anybody here has been particularly enamored with the process that's gone on for this part of it. Too much. I mean, I haven't been too impressed with it, and I don't feel that
For them?
What?
For the Stato piece of it, or all
for this, of it? This little, this present project, the yeah. Stato project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I think there's meetings and everything's just going ahead, and people comment, and people do this, but I don't think that that people have ever felt that they have any real say or control on what's happening in the local Maine.
And I think part of that is because they are in this phase now where they are trying to gather the information to include in their plan that they do submit to us, and that would be part of their lease when they get a lease as well. So I think they're just in a taking phase right now still until they actually write it all down in a plan and submit it to the right. government. I think you'll be able to see something concrete. And
at that point, though, it'll be beyond any of us. It'll be okay. That's acceptable plan, and then it's on.
Because you've already done the review for the entire East Coast, right? What was that study? The environmental impact study for the whole East Coast. So once these guys say, not four, but this many, you go, okay, the study's already done. Here we go.
No, I mean, once again, Stato is a kind of a unique situation. We're going to be doing this whole EIS. TOP is the second, but it's also going to be our lease issuance vehicle, too. Mm-hmm. So there's that EIS will look at the project. And everywhere else on the Atlantic Coast is doing it, but they're doing it piecemeal. We're doing only a lease. Here's your lease. But you're only allowed to start your surveys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're only allowed to do your site characterization activity. And then once you finish that, then you have to submit a construction operations plan. And we'll do an EIS on the construction operations plan. So it's a two-step NEPA process pretty much everywhere else, except here where it's going to be one EIS basically for the whole project.
Now, one thing I also wondered is that, of course, there's the other big gorilla in the house, and that's deep sea wind, which would be what? 40 miles east, or I mean, it's so on, and so they haven't submitted yet. But as you know, they just got $40 million, was it, or some large sum anyway? They wish it was 40 million. Maybe next year, though, right? But anyway, so I mean, that will have to be factored in. It's not so close as to be a wind shadow problem, but it certainly is a, you know, as far as water currents, the flights of birds, and all that, it'd be.
Once we know about, once we actually have an application, we'll have to look at those cumulative required to do that.
I wonder, because I've seen that, just something I saw in a report there, that a memo or something there, that between deep sea wind and Statoil, there's no love lost, let's say. I mean, there was a... When Statoil applied to the Public Utility Commission, they say Deep Sea Wind was right there saying no, don't grant this to them. And so it's capitalism.
Deep Sea Wind isn't talking about doing anything in federal waters right now, so it wouldn't be on their radar because they're just talking about the Monhegan work. Even that Department of Energy funding is still just for the Monhegan site. So I mean, there's just not. Beep talks big, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's where they're
at.
You
did mention,
right?
Yeah, but 40 something.
Yes.
Right. Again, that's the big plan is for them. Again, you do the four, and then and then you go big.
Well, I think one of the disconnects that what this is hitting on is the difference between ORPC's work, which was so local, and having a Maine-based company with an office that has been established very early on, and it seems like the Statoil work,
underwater,
that there's been question as to where the project is going, and I know they've talked about hiring a liaison, but to our knowledge, we haven't met anybody that has identified themselves as such, so I think having that as a best practice is great, and then trying to give some guidance as to when that person comes on, because I think the longer that we go without having that person on the ground, the harder it's going to be.
Just remember, backing up, this truth. When they have to address the DMPs, it has to be specifically in that federal process.
Yeah.
So you can't like go to them as soon as they have an idea. Say, you got to go find.
But I mean, they're already in the process
that,
right now.
If there's work, that should be.
Of course. But I mean, I think that it's everybody always says really in office.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's true.
And we've met them that have done this.
A couple things with our project that kind of ties into this. Again, it's different from a federal level. It's FERC that we deal with, not BOEM. But our project is under a pilot license, so there's actually the ability, if there's negative environmental impact, for that license to be canceled. And so that only allows us to build out so far before we go to it. And that's a little different than the whole process. But also we have, our license requires us to have an adaptive management plan. So we need to continuously evaluate the monitoring data, and we have a team with our regulators, our technical advisors, as well as us, to make decisions on modifying the monitoring, whether it's increased or decreased, or you know, different techniques, to try to really understand what the risk is and the proportionality.
Could it even lead to like adjusting the locations if it turned out, you know, all that monitoring said you need to move a quarter mile this way or something?
Well, no, not necessarily, but that would be easier to do if it wasn't a fixed, we actually have a fixed foundation on the seafloor. And certainly where our resource is so defined versus offshore wind, there's a little more flexibility to move offshore wind sites than a tidal resource.
I'm sorry, I forgot that'd be fixed. Yeah, so,
but those are certainly things that are applicable to the BOEM process as well.
And we do have in our regulations that, you know, if there is basically an unforeseen environmental impact, yeah, we have the ability to cancel the lease as well, built into our regulations. And this particular process, they decided to ask for a commercial lease primarily because of the export cable and that it's going to be producing electricity, as opposed to we do have a research lease, but generally that's more for technology testing, and it's not clear, you know, it'll be for generating grid time. So that's more slightly different in the role of the
So I'm just going to say this, and it applies to a lot of places, is that when you consider best management practices, I think that you should consider it from the point of view of reality rather than regulation. I mean, if you're not asked to regulate it, then but you're trying to do best management practices, best management means what you would want to be true rather than what is regulated. So if, you know, like in this communication stuff, you know, there could be a list of ways to contact fishermen and or that this, you know, you can, it says considering a long-term committee of stakeholders, you know, you can make that a little stronger than consider.
Yeah, and this isn't exhausted.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying, you know.
No, that's the kind of stuff
that's
we,
what we want to do.
Right. That's exactly, you know, like if it's best practice, consider it as best practice rather than regulation, because, you know, what the feds regulate is not necessarily, you know, those people can't think of everything that they need to, in every law they need to pass. I mean, it's impossible.
And you know, once again, and that's why there's some flexibility with best management practices, you know, how they evolve, and, you know, what works. And, you know, we're not going to make public notice and comment on the best management practices. It's going to be just a framework that we say, you know, look, guys, here's our best management practices. You know, when you submit your plan, you know, you should reflect, you know, these to, to a certain level.
And you have the right to say we don't think that's a that
right. I mean, in some communities, one single fisheries liaison, you know, may be adequate. In other places where you have a really disparate amount of folks, a committee or some kind of standing committee may be the more effective means. And I think, you know, I think that's what we're trying to get at is opinions in different areas as to, you know, what methodology.
Right. So if you have a fisherman liaison, is that from, would that be end up being a Statoil?
That's an issue that comes up. Who should pay for it? It should be independent. Is it money just granted by Statoil to a family? Like,
yeah.
You know, do they give money to Maine Lobstermen's Association?
It's all going
to
be looked at differently.
Maine Lobstermen's Association. Here's
it's a nice dog. I won't bite that hand.
Or do they hire someone on their staff? Mm-hmm. You know, you could have different approaches, and obviously there's a potential conflict of interest if people feel like he's a direct hire of the industry, so therefore he's just going to be an industry mouthpiece. When that's not the purpose of a liaison, the purpose of a liaison is just to facilitate communication to make sure issues are raised and heard.
are we going through the whole thing here? We're not just stuck on page one, right? Because there were a couple things on page two I wanted to discuss. One is spacing of turbines. They talk about the safe passage of boats, reasons, you know, the footprints and so on. But of course, the most important factor that gets considered, or one of the key factors, is wind shadow. That is, they can't be closer than a certain amount or you start losing velocity on the wind. And so that needs to be added into the list there, because all you're mentioning is safe passage, minimize footprint, you know, promote safety and exclusion zones.
Well, this is, remember, these are what the fishermen have suggested to us.
Okay.
For how they would propose to a developer to arrange a...
Right. But, I mean, you're going to always have to tell them first, we can't put them any closer together than X.
Well, okay. I would assume they should know that.
The developer.
The developer, he has to...
Because for efficiency, I mean, wouldn't it be cost-effective?
Right, but, I mean, so the area that it might be in could be a lot, you know, smaller or larger than one might think, depending on the prevailing winds, et cetera, and so
exactly.
on. Okay.
And I think we had a... I think there's one comment about that, Ron, and it was like a density issue for the size of the space. Because that has something to do with how you could get
it. I think there was like a Delaware and New Jersey project, and they wanted to make sure they were far enough apart. One of them said, well, we're going to move because we're too close, you know?
Yeah.
And the wind shadowed. All right, the other thing was number two, studies and analysis, studies that should be prepared. And the one that I'm trying not just to be like a constant pain in the neck about. I gave out a couple of these here. This little slide says functional changes. Now, if you look at the top of that, it says, you know, from the anticipated environmental effects of this. So Peter Jumars is the head of the Ocean Sciences Department there. And so what he wrote about here is that there's a study done by a Norwegian back in 2008 that shows that, you know, depending on the number of windmills in a location, the amount of energy lost to the ocean surface behind them, depending on how far, will cause a large upwelling to occur. And as he said, you know, there's a copy of it here, but this effect could be important offshore because deep waters of the Gulf might stratify in the summer. Would it be good or bad? It is yet untested. Now, untested things could be important because I think the great advantage of being offshore, you know, is that you have the capability of being away from a lot of the, you know, problems that plague Cape Wind, you know, people screaming, you can see them. So, but the thing is that if the water stratified in the summer with, you know, one temperature below, one above, nutrient mix is different, and you have something that's several mile, a water column that's vertical, that's several square miles, it's going to have an effect on, you know, on the surface currents coming by. Let's say this is colder water, you got a warmer water flow hitting it. It's kind of like hitting a wall, and then it's going to go around it. If you have this constant,
okay, cool. Yeah, we have this issue has a few.
So I've, I'd like, yes. Here's the. And so the thing is that it's even on the national. Well, here's a copy if you want to see of the article that he was referring to, and it's got the different calculations. He noted that shallow water ones, the water is so turbulent and mixed, it doesn't make a difference. But once you're in deep water where you have stratification, you want to look at this. And the challenge has been getting folks to add that into as a study. It may be that it'll be inconsequential with the four or with the eight or however many, but what Peter Jumars told me was that he felt that four full-size ones should be enough to have the effect occur. The four little ones, like the, you know, the deep sea winds, one-third size or whatever, not. But the four full-size ones, it would be.
Well, then that would just be part of it. Within that NEPA process, that would be another category of impact. Okay.
Right. So it is a study that, as you said, should be done there. I just want to put it on record here that this is a study that we'd like to get done.
Yeah, Bohm wants to, because there's
anything
a lot of...
in the you're subtracting energy out of the tidal stream. I mean,
yeah, so
what he's talking about, basically, we all go to high school.
We have six different environmental watering plans as part of our compliance, and one of them is a hydraulic watering plan, so we actually have instruments that take wake measurements off, and then those wake measurements, they're called ADCPs, or acoustic Doppler current profilers. So we have near close wake to take wake measurements, but also in other areas. But that gets put into a hydraulic model to actually evaluate what the impacts are, you know, close to the turbines, further away from the turbines. So it's similar with wind. You're talking about kind of a wind water interface type of dynamic. But we have, you know, it's in our license that we need to do those types
of things. So you're licensed by somebody else?
FERC, right?
FERC. Because it's underground, underwater?
Because we're in state waters.
You're in state waters, okay.
But also because we fall under their hydropower division.
Okay. Right, just like a hydropower dam.
So it might be good to cross-check other regular...
But you can't subtract energy out of flowing water without slowing it down or doing something, right?
Yeah, that kind of came up in Castine.
You've affected the environment.
No more than a 12% slowdown of the velocity, or else the plankton will never get up to the oyster farms in the Upper Bagadoo.
So you need, so you need to take measurements and try to. And the real key question is what's significant and what's not. And so that's.
So that's what you're actually gathering info now that you're doing it in real time. You've got the thing there. You've got assume current meters on both sides and so on, right?
We did one. We actually ED worked with DOE on the project on the Gulf Stream. It was interesting. We went to this one meeting, the Associated Energy meeting, and one of the professors says, he says, you can't do that. He says, and basically, it wasn't that they wouldn't run and produce it. He said, it wouldn't be economically feasible to build all these because you wouldn't get the output. You know, this is an oil stream. And it was interesting. He had always done a whole model on that. You know, 99.9% of the people there were looking at, you know, issues for development or doing this technology. And this one guy says, can't be done. It was interesting.
Yeah.
The cold equations.
The industry's in a difficult position because you've got to rely on models. Nobody really wants to rely on models.
No.
So what you've got to do is try to rely on the information that's out there, like in the North Sea, you know, to actually take measurements and try to quantify what the
Just like what Ronnie showed us with this study, what's out there, it's been done.
Yeah.
And it just hasn't been done.
What do you this one?
Can I keep this?
Yeah, if you don't mind,
go ahead.
Yeah. And
I can look it up.
And what's his name there?
Done in deep water is what he said.
Right, you see.
If you have fixed turbines that are on the ground, that means shallow, relatively shallow water compared to
so you have a unique opportunity here. It may be that it just, you said it becomes a great little fish farm there that bringing up happy plankton and all that, but then again.
Well, and that's been brought up at other meetings. It's like, you know, these devices are going to be out there and they're able to use them to measure what's going on and find out, you know, what else can be done with them, you know,
a lot of the agencies bring their wish lists.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just like how the challenge is.
Absolutely.
So the one thing
I just want to answer your question. There's an agreement between BOEM and FERC to talk to each other.
Okay.
They do have an agreement.
And so studies would be cross-pollinated.
They have a memorandum.
Okay. Potential for hydrokinetic projects in the Outer Continental Shelf. Yeah. So there's a MOU with FERC and BOEM. That's a ways off. But the wave energy is probably.
Yeah, absolutely. She had that.
Oh, I remember that sort of came and went for. Five years ago in Maine, but have they come up with another wave energy system that works?
I was just going to say that the more that these reports get prepared, I think to have a system that talks about how deep water technology varies.
But there's nothing close to be proposed.
I think because DOE has put a priority on deep water development, because that's all we anticipate seeing for the time being in Maine, we'd just like to be able to have the studies that are created be relevant to what we anticipate seeing.
Yeah, that's kind of a bold suggestion.
For the reports that are prepared. And obviously there's much less data available for that because not many have been deployed, but to point out where it may vary or be helpful for us up here.
Or what should be studied because...
Because it's different.
It's different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a challenge for anybody in this, any of these industries, because everything's so different.
Yeah, we created a series of fact sheets last year that looked at sort of the academic literature, tried to put it in plain English, and there were a series of five of them. One of them was about impact to marine species, and it, you know, obviously there's a lot of things that are different because of the deep water piece, because we don't have the fixed foundation and all of that. So it was hard for us to figure that out. You know, we talked to a lot of other scientists, and we talked to folks at OM, but I just think going forward, if that's going to be a priority for this country, we all of that, it would be good to have the research
that.
Well, has there been a has this company, have they done anything similar to what they're proposing here in Norway?
Yeah, they have the Highwind project.
Yeah. I thought so.
There's also a company called Principal Power that's in Portland. There's also a floating one in Japan.
How long have those been out there?
About 2 years.
The Norwegian one has been 3.5 months for them. And the Portugal one has only been a year or two. Just this piece under the cabling, I think the idea of collaborative discussions. Again, Maine, we have a lot of examples of cables that are already here, so I think it's sort of a great opportunity to learn from what's already been deployed. We took a group of fishermen that Richard was a part of to the University of Maine almost 2 years ago now. To talk with some submarine cable engineers that laid some of the cables, to have a discussion about fishermen's experience with gear and how that relates to submarine cables, and I think it was a pretty cool discussion.
It was pretty cool. The thing that I find funny is that he said there's no such thing as
EMF. Yeah, he did say
that. You know, so you go to two of these meetings, and one guy who's supported expert in the cable business swears up and down there's no sense you're talking about. There's no such thing.
He says an armored cable.
There's
a
double armored cable, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's no such thing.
Somebody
else is studying.
There's somebody from SGC whose name I can't remember off the top of my head, but if he said it, I would know it.
He's not very sensitive.
Well, I think that on a large part it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Right.
It's like most of it from escaping, but obviously there, at some level,
It also depends on if it's buried or if it's on the surface.
Exactly. He said if an armored cable is buried, then you're minimizing the vast majority of any of the issues. But anyways, I think we have that here in Maine. Our organization's really interested to try to connect those people and have those conversations in person.
Who is
it's a really good one.
The company? The Island Institute. That was
Who did you guys go talk to?
It was a cable company called SGC.
We've had a few cable people.
Is it the same as the consulting firm SGC?
Yeah.
That's just that's a really good. I just appreciate that's a really good point. And just to make, you know, there are so many cables and because of all the islands out here, and so to use that experience and utilize those resources here, because that's a discussion that's ongoing.
I think people found it interesting just to understand the process of how it's laid and you know how long it's going to take. I mean, people really want to know how that works.
Because that's been a question that's come up so much in other meetings. Yeah, that's awesome.
One of the groups suggested taking fishermen to Norway and Europe to let them see the. I mean, that's already done.
I think that would be the chef.
One
of the proponents actually said, I would be willing to support that. That was interesting.
I would suggest that as well.
Well, so much on the engineering, what we've heard is that nobody believes this stuff is going to withstand the Gulf of Maine conditions.
Right.
And so a lot of it has been for Statoil to show their flashy videos of a turbine not falling over.
I just put a post on Facebook on a Naraku site, which is the weather buoy. And they had this one buoy that just got loose again. And it was the same buoy that got loose last winter. And I said something to the effect of, well, I want to figure, you know, 10 more years we'll have, but we'll be chasing down the wind turbines. As well as the weather. Because if you guys can't figure out how to anchor one that's already broken, broken twice already.
Well, and that is, I mean, one of the floating rigs let loose in Katrina, too.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So that's it does happen.
That's a huge issue between the European studies and the U.S. I mean, just the conditions.
That's like the year getting snarled. Where the fishermen have that expression, if it can't snarl, it will. If it can't this, it will. It will at some time. You know,
well, engineers are going to tell you nothing's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Because they engineered it.
It'll be there forever.
Yeah.
I had a couple questions from this morning. He mentioned shutdown. Does that mean that the blade stops turning?
That's what he said. That's what they have right in this.
Well, I mean, it's not even you could shut off the generation.
No, he said it stops the blade.
It stops the blade.
Yeah.
I think it was 5 minutes, 5 or 15,
two.
I think.
Two.
Okay.
Two.
Yeah, I surprised.
Yeah, like a big red button.
It has to be shut down in 2 minutes.
All turbines are remotely monitored like that. Yeah. So, I mean, the ones on Vinyl Haven, they do the same thing. So that's standard technology these days. It's not like they have to do anything special. Yeah.
So they just feather their blades.
That's why you see them actually stopped in some conditions.
When he mentioned, they talked about distance between the turbines and distances in meters. Is there any figures in nautical miles? Just a lot of fishermen.
He did have that. In fact, that came
in the
up.
Yeah.
And he, in the, yeah, the slide, it says 0.6 to 0.8 nautical miles.
Close to objects like that will go by our radar circles, which might be set up as a quarter mile.
And there's a really big diagram over there, but it's in his presentation, too. Yeah. Right by the door,
right.
There's one that's got it in nautical miles.
There is.
It's 0.6 to 0.8 nautical miles.
Okay.
And the larger the rotors get, the larger the spacing gets, so the more wind there is, the larger the rotors are, the larger the spacing. Once they get up to around 10 megawatts per turbine, which is, you know, in the next couple of years, which is, I mean, that sounds huge. I figure what it is. It's like 140 houses or something like that. Originally, Brian was saying he's not saying it anymore, so maybe it's changed, but they're looking at around 1 nautical mile spacing. So the direction it's going in, more capacity, larger rotors, means more spacing, which means better safety.
And less turbines,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, less turbines.
There would be less turbines.
Less turbines, they can, less towers.
One can bring more energy in than five that we have now. So that would be planned now.
How about gear as far as fishermen are concerned? Let's say with this stat oil proposal.
Well, I'll go back to where we are. They put a new, to the weather buoys, they put a new weather buoy out by me to keep track of the Egan site conditions. And that gets snarled up with gear. I mean, I'm just putting a buoy there. Because this lobster gear is not only... Are they people going to set near these things if they are allowed to whatsoever? But it moves. You know, you get a storm and all that gear moves around sometimes too. Mm. So it's going to. I think gear will get snarled into it.
Yeah, that's been a big discussion with our project. I wouldn't say it's been a heated discussion at all, but. There's been a lot of questions. And so there's kind of two different things. One is what happens if a fisherman becomes has a bottom trawl and actually trawls up the cable, which is, there's a lot of precedence out there.
Right.
Another one is if there's lost gear and it gets tangled in the trawl, causes damage, is the fisherman responsible? I think the answer to the latter is no. Because once you've lost gear, you're not responsible.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the actual knowingly, or not knowingly, as long as the developer properly marks on charts, then it's the responsibility of the fisherman to avoid those errors. And there's the possibility that stuff moves, then that becomes a legal case of justification.
Or the cable's exposed marked? Or something like that.
Or is the cable moved or whatever.
But that would go into NOAA's charts and onto the electric charts, and
right.
So on.
And so, if it's properly marked, it'll be the responsibility of the mariner to obligate with those. But if it's, so there's a lot of gray areas, but I think there's a session tomorrow morning on gear conflict stuff, and a lot of it's, even though it's not focused on the renewable industry, it's the same. Maritime law is kind of has its whole can of worms. It's different than other types of law, so it's so there's a lot of there's a lot of complexity into it.
I had a question actually, just from your real experience of actually getting something on a chart. How long did it take to actually, you know, get your project put on the charts and out for production?
Months. It wasn't. You know, they put it online, and then every new chart they actually issue will have it on it.
Okay.
But it went online, I would say, within a few months.
That was their responsibility to do it, right?
We provide the NOAA Office of, I forget what it is, mapping.
The biggest lag would be for the individual mariners to update their chart.
Exactly.
So we work with,
which would allow to be electronic charts,
right,
and things
which
like
is
that.
So that's a really big issue because, you know, it a lot, I would say the vast majority are not going to have the most recent charts.
Right.
And even if you have a chart plotter, you know, it's whatever date the software is. So it doesn't
necessarily. And that's been one of the suggestions as a BMP also is to, you know, enhance that whole, you know, exposure to what new information's out there, kind of make it their responsibility because they're the ones that are benefiting from it. You know, like you said, new chips. People have talked about, you know, new chips for radars or GPS systems, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of guys had some. There's one, you know, a couple people that are developers of Fisherman's Energy.
Yep.
And, you know, so they kind of look at it from both sides too. What would be good for the fishermen and for the.
Yeah, that's right. So there's
My software is about 13 years old.
Yeah, that's what one of the fishermen said. He said, provide me that would do me good. Because
it's good for an update.
Somebody just told me.
So there'd be good, a federal loan for that would be good.
It's amazing the amount. One of the fishermen just told me the other day. I don't know my father, but there's amazingly amount of new information, and not on renewable energy, but on agriculture sites, on ship channels, you know, that is continuously.
Most of that will be part of. Most fishermen in Maine are concentrated on a local area, and they would be familiar with what's happening in that local area. But like you said, there's a few new. Scallop boats and move a little bit from area.
Yeah,
area.
Right.
Every minority, but still happens.
Right.
Now, this probably isn't the right thing here or not, but I guess, you know, where it's reducing conflicts and so on, and that is that I remember Dr. Dagger of Deep Sea Wind a number of times said the technology is there and the rightness is there to sight these things over the horizon. That is, you know, take them out of sight of land for the various reasons of, you know, of aesthetics and scenic resources. And now that's not a fishing / wind industry thing, so I didn't know if this is the right place to bring it up.
Well, that's one of those VOLA issues because, I mean, we're kind of, with VOLA, they're already in the process, they've already designated the liaison. So what we're here to do is try to figure out, like, now that they've already done that, what are we going to do about, you know, mitigation?
Mm-hmm, right.
I mean, that's something.
Yeah,
for BOEM to consider,
okay.
Whoever.
If the technology is there, and Suzanne, you'd probably know better than I do about that. But.
I mean, part of the question is over whose horizon, because when you live on an island,
right.
You live on an island 12 miles out, just because it's 25 miles from Rockland doesn't mean.
Right. That well, I know, but. Obviously, then they would certainly use the mainland as a thing, because otherwise.
But somebody still sees it.
Right.
I mean, it's just a factor of how much power you can produce at that distance.
Right.
If you can go farther out, you get a better wind resource.
That's right, and the main thing is avoiding the
conflict. You can cover the additional cost of running the cable.
Right, I thought that was the limiting factor. You can't get far enough away, you're losing too much of your power of transmission.
That's part of it, and the cable
cost. Of the
transmission.
Yeah, exactly. Not even so much the loss, but just the cost of laying it.
So if the cable is underground, and they're going to monitor it, so they're monitoring whether or not it comes up, or they're monitoring whether or not it breaks?
They'll know if it breaks.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
If it leaks or anything that...
Yeah, you want to... We have our cable inspection plan, but it's part of our inspection maintenance plan for the integrity of the cable.
Right.
But also for... We have a benthic environmental monitoring plan that we actually have to monitor the cable to see if there's impacts to the bedrooms.
So your point was, how do you monitor the buried cables?
That's one of my questions, yeah. How do you monitor the buried cables?
Sub-bottom profilers, and you've got all kinds of magnetometers.
And if it's technically buried, it wouldn't have any impact on the bentholes.
No.
So, other than from potentially from the installation, depending on how you install it.
But the thing isn't ever going to erode, or
There's that potential.
Well,
there's also, in most places in Maine, you're not going to run a cable without going over hard bottom. And so there are going to be places that it either will be exposed, you're going to have to put concrete mats over it, or you're going to have to weigh it down with collars. So there's different ways you can do that. But there's most likely will be portions that will be buried and portions that will be exposed.
So then the monitoring issue that he was talking about was whether they raise up, if they're 6 feet under, and they start to come up. What was he...
Yeah, he said if there's a stipulation for a 6 foot burial depth, then it likely be the proponent's requirement to monitor that depth requirement. But I tell you, I work on pipelines a lot too, undersea pipelines. They're going to be exposed sooner or later, and like you mentioned, typically the engineer is going to know these kind of things. If you've got a protrusion, hard bottom protrusion, not much sediment, they're going to mat it, concrete mat it. Because, it's to their benefit. They don't want that thing to get...
It's in their best interest to not have it.
Yeah, it's cheaper to put in concrete mats than it is to replace a cable. But then they've got the character, some of these concrete, these mats are, they're interesting in their own regard. Plastic covers over the gears.
Yeah, and there's an impact of those.
I just did the Neptune study, and we found out that they're very good habitat enhancers. Fisheries, benthics, all kinds of stuff.
So that's one factor, I guess. It's you're introducing a new forms of habitat out in open water. You now have this vertical habitat that biofouled and so on, and that's not necessarily good if for example that's in a current where the lobster larvae are flowing by. Now there's a base of operations for lobster larvae eaters to work out of. Don't know whether that would ever be it, but
there's a side to each story.
Yeah, that question's come up quite a bit with biofouling and whether it's actually an aggregator, an actual cause. Prey species to come close to our turbine and be at higher risk.
So it'll make a change anyway. Both sides.
Who wants it, right?
Right. So it's one more thing to keep your.
When it comes to technical studies, like I said, we've had a lot of agency folks and scientists. There's a whole list of things they'd like to. There's questions that basically arise that nobody really knows. For some of these things, even when you go through the EIS process, you can't always answer every question.
Well, that's part of
speaking of biofouling. Do they are all these things coated with like some kind of bottom paint on that resists that fouling, or is that kind
of offshore? I assume this.
Wish they used pepper paint or something. Use that cayenne pepper paint or something, so you're not going to be outgassing copper into the water column.
Traditionally, they've been a lot more dangerous than cayenne pepper.
Yeah.
I would anticipate that there would be some sort of biofouling. But I could be wrong. We don't have any on our device because we actually have routine maintenance where we bring it out of the water and we pressure wash. I would assume I could be wrong. I would assume some of this stuff.
Factor to look at.
I've talked about to UNH. They have an offshore aquaculture site, and they have a lot of biofouling on their anchor system, which is similar to the offshore wind that actually has caused some problems.
That would just be regulated under whoever's regulating bottom paint or that type of
fall
stuff.
Probably under main DEP.
Even if it was out in federal waters, the thing.
I'm not sure in Bowen's case. Would regulate
that?
Yeah.
NIMS
or EPA or something?
It's a water quality issue, so with the EPA or the...
EPA, because if there's an MPDS permit required, they would get into all of that.
Is it there's any, yeah,
there's discharge been a, I mean, there's, there, yeah.
They've been cutting back the allowable substances in paint over the last whatever it is, 20 years. Mm-hmm.
There's a whole bunch of rules under Marin, too. Address some of those kind of
things. So all those rules apply to these people?
That's just kind of what I was.
Yeah.
Part of
the whole.
Yeah, typically, yeah. I mean, under that, under the NEPA development process, they, you know, you look at all the federal regulations that apply to that habitat and that process, you know. So, you know, it has to consider like everything from essential fish habitat, endangered species, you know what I mean, transportation.
Can
risk,
you say what NEPA is?
Risk.
Oh.
Excuse me.
National Environmental Policy Act.
That might be in one of the little, one of the many flyers we've given you.
Okay.
There might be a one of them.
Contiguous thing that standardizes reviewing any federal environmental.
Clearly, BOEM's not required, doesn't, can't require this.
What?
But it's interesting that there's still so much of this in here. Is that that it can be included as a suggested best practice?
Which item are you?
No, I think what we're trying to do here is we're trying to not limit anybody's comment in the process.
So recognize
what Yeah. It's almost like we don't want to say, oh, I'll just keep, it has nothing to do with it, because there's so many issues that come up. We've got a whole bunch of them.
Well, like you brought up before, things that aren't covered under BOEM, but that are important.
Yeah.
And these are, some of these are contingency upon loss of gear and things like that, which would be different than.
Yeah, well, and it says down here loss of opportunity.
Benefit
I think the primary concern we've heard is just because there's so much commercial fishing in the Gulf of Maine that lost access is a real concern.
Right.
And that somebody's livelihood that's directly impacted because there's just so much fishing. It's not like you can just go next door, somebody else is already fishing.
Right.
So.
The NEPA process includes very hard looks at sociocultural and economic impact, so that's all included in the environmental analysis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is weighed at some point by the agency's decision making.
Sure. But ultimately, it's going to be the developer.
It's sort of
going to make the move on that.
Closing bits of the commons here and there.
Compensatory type stuff.
Sure, it doesn't go.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, that's what's happened everywhere else.
But it's really difficult to separate that from the regulatory process when that's the number one concern.
Yeah.
So I think it's useful for BOEM to be able to find ways to still bring this into the conversation, even though they can't mandate anything. It's going to affect people's involvement in the process.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, we've done a fair amount of research to look at the various models that are out there that have been used for other offshore projects in Europe and then other offshore projects here in the U.S. And just tried to share that as a resource so that people can be familiar with what developers and in some cases state governments have asked for in other places. So I think sharing that is something that we try to do, and I don't think as BOEM can't, but I mean I think just pointing to examples,
yeah.
Can't require anything, but just being able to share what has happened in other states in terms of this type of structure. And the other thing that we've really dug into a fair amount over the last year, because somebody actually brought it up at the forum last year, is this question of fishermen being pretty entrepreneurial and saying, okay, well, you can kind of come over and put this project over my fishing permit, and I can be external to this whole process, or I can try to get inside. And is there a way for a local investment or local ownership? And, you know, there are a lot of models in Europe that we've researched where there's community ownership and offshore wind. There's discussions of elements of that with a couple of projects here in the U.S., and I think we've watched in particular this project off of Martha's Vineyard, the Vineyard Power Project that's working with Offshore MW, where there is a local electric cooperative that's been formed to try to be a part of that process. They've directly influenced the siting of that project through a community process. And then they partner with an offshore developer, with a European developer, to put something forward. And it's been interesting for us to watch the response to that project through the BOEM process, because when they did the comments on the RFI down there, 60 or 70% of the comments that were received related to this one project, even though they could have commented on 11 different projects. And all of them were in favor of the project because there's a constituency on the island that had bought into it, because they were able to influence where it was sited, and they were going to have some level of ownership and get the power from that project. So to us, it's all really interesting because we've supported islands to take a role in owning their own renewable energy resources, whether it be wind or solar. And I think that's a model that resonates here in Maine. So I think to be able to learn about those models and share that,
okay.
But the process is still going on. I mean, as is happening, it may come to some sort of a conclusion. And all these things require, you know, stating that it's part of the NEPA process, or stating that all these things might happen is a big leap of faith.
If everybody could try to bring your conversations to a close in the next minute or so, that would be helpful.
Guarantees, you know what I mean?
Well, the problem with that position
help me
for all of us is that we can only work under the regulations that are out there. You know what I mean? Right. That's one of those people always say that to me, and I go, well, it's just up to us to change it if you don't like the process. I mean, you know, we got to meet with it because of public issues. You know? That's how the act came about. So it's funny, we're now moving to another phase. Everything's so far off. Sure, people, at first they didn't think about it. Now it's like, wait a minute.
Well, you know, the nice thing is with Chris Rector, who I seem to recall went to just about every wind power meeting while he was a legislator, you know, every ocean wind power meeting up and down the coast. He's certainly going to be an informed advisor to Angus King, our senator here, you know, because he knows of what you all speak. At least, I'm sure it's all rubbed off on him, all these meetings he's been talking about.
He's
a smart guy.
All right, folks, if you can wrap up your conversations, that would be great.
Yep.
We'll give everybody a minute to stand up and stretch their legs, and then we'll reconvene for...